This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm at the University of Waikato. I'm in the office of Dr. Pip Wallace, who is the convener of the Environmental Planning Program at the University of Waikato. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So what does the convener of Environmental Planning do?
Well, it's a role within the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, and it's basically administrating and organising the environmental planning program and generally related to the degrees that we deliver and the research we do in that area.
And that's in the Department of Geography, Tourism and Environmental Planning?
No longer. It's in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, but we have our own program now in environmental planning.
Cool. So let's cover off your background, shall we? Because it's an interesting background. Because I'm sitting here in an environmental planning thing surrounded by what looks like legal documents.
That's case law. That's the torture that I put my fourth year planning students through on a weekly basis. Yes, my background is in law, and I came to the university as a result of my practice in resource management law in the Waikato and in the Auckland area and in London as well. And so I came through a traditional legal route, but it was due to the work that I've done in environmental law that I ended up teaching here.
Let's go back some further bits. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Auckland.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
A Formula One race car driver. But I didn't get to do that. And then I thought I'd be a child doctor, but I was really bad at maths.
So you decided on law?
Well, law kind of got me in the end. I guess it claimed me. It became the typical subject that you go into when you have strengths in the arts and perhaps in some of the sciences.
And did you, from the outset, want to get into environmental resource law?
No, I didn't. It was a good path, an interesting path. I was always interested in litigation and in court work, and I initially thought I would be, you know, doing criminal law, family law, probably, various litigation, and I did start there, but it wasn't really until I did a stint in London as a reasonably recent graduate, and I worked first for a firm in Chancery Lane doing criminal defence work. I could only work as a solicitor, not as a barrister in London. And then from there I did a stint with the London Borough of Southwark. It's a real rough borough, full of estates and very degraded and run down, and I had to do the things like the noise prosecution and the environmental health prosecutions, and it was incredibly eye-opening to a young woman from New Zealand in terms of the environment that the people inhabited, and it made me refocus on environmental law and management, really.
Is environmental law the same the world over?
It is very similar, yes, but the conditions are different, and I think that was what was so different for me. I'm used to wide open spaces and a lot of sea, and I'd meet people who'd never been to the sea, and I had weeks when I'd never see any grass, and I found that experience alien. It was a fabulous experience. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed seeing how other people live their lives, but it did make me realise that when we all live close together, that there's quite a lot of issues that arise, and it also made me more aware as I travelled around the world about the degradation of resources. That's something that I hadn't been quite so aware of when I left New Zealand, but certainly by the time I got back I had a much better understanding.
We talked to several people about the dichotomy between nature and people, and is nature out there somewhere in reserves and the cities are somewhere separate. So it's interesting that you first studied environmental law in one of the world's greatest cities,
yes,
with the least environment, if you will.
Yeah, I know, and it's actually slowly fed my ideas on how I feel about humans and nature and coexistence and human domination, and how I've come to the views that I've formed now that we're not really doing very well in that area, and that we are becoming over-dominant in the way we use and exploit resources to the expense of the other creatures.
So can you give us Environmental Law 101? The very, very short version.
The very short version of it. Well,
How do you introduce it?
As a topic? Well, in terms of teaching it? Well, here, it's not really. See, even though I have taught environmental law at the law school, here it's very different because I'm teaching planning students, and a lot of what I'm teaching them is frameworks and understanding how our systems work, but I'm also introducing them to the resources as well. One of the things that was really formative for me was moving to the Waikato from Auckland as well, and moving into a rural environment, living on a working farm is also part of my background, and that's a major change from an urban area. And a lot of these things have taught me about the way we use our resources both in rural and urban, and I had a more idyllic idea of the rural environment when I came here than I came to realise was the reality. And so in terms of resources, I guess a focus for us here is how resources are used. And so a lot of the work we do initially with the students, say in the first year of the Bachelor of Environmental Planning, which is a new degree we've started here, specialising on environmental planning, it's a 4-year dedicated degree. A lot of what we do to begin with is actually getting students interfacing with resources, resource use, and beginning to understand how humans interact with the environment and the processes and activities that need to be managed. And that's where the law comes in, because the law sets up those frameworks. But we have to look at all the other things, like the ethical perspectives that underpin how we approach and create those frameworks, and how they can be different in different places and for different cultures and people. So there's a lot of work that we do at the beginning that is very introductory.
So is environmental planning a discipline in its own right?
Yes, it is. It's a profession in its own right. In New Zealand, it's, you know, the degree, for instance, is accredited by the New Zealand Planning Institute, and law is seen as a core subject in a degree for planning because of that regulatory framework and background and processes that are so heavily involved in environmental management.
So you've come at it from law, but you don't have to.
That's right. That's right. I've come at it from law. And really my role here, a lot of it is pastoral, looking after the students and caring for the degree and getting things going. And I teach a lot of papers which are tied into our statutes and our frameworks and things like that. But certainly it is coming from a legal perspective.
So I'm going to try again on Environmental Law 101.
Yeah.
How is the environment considered in law? We hear about things like corporations getting rights as people and things. Hmm. Environment's not that?
No. Really, the way the environment is treated at law, the main thing is the way we regulate human activity in relation to the environment. So it's about restricting humans' rights in terms of how they choose to use the environment, and also looking at what their duties are in terms of using the environment. So we frame that in our law. But often, quite often, I think that there's not very careful recognition of what the environment's rights are. And a lot of the work that I've done more recently is looking at how the law works to distribute harm and benefit to non-human aspects of the environment. And so in terms of how does the law treat the environment, really the law is more focused on regulation of people and their actions in relation to how we use and allocate environmental resources.
On your website, you've got a whole list of things as special focus areas, and conservation, biodiversity, threatened species, and so on and so on.
Yes.
And there's a question in there about, is that the nature of being involved in the environment that you have so many special focus areas?
Quite possibly, because the definition of environment, even at law, is huge. You know, it involves people and communities as well, and so we're looking at impacts on people as well as on animals, as well as on soil quality and water quality. It is very, very broad. You couldn't be a specialist on every area related to that. So a lot of what we do is related to the processes and rights and distribution and aspects like that.
So how do you get your head across all of that?
With a great deal of difficulty.
Are there some core principles that apply to everything?
There are core frameworks, some of them which have principles which can be extracted from it. There are principles, wider principles that you'd find in international law, entrenched in different ways in law. But in terms of core principles... Yes, in relation to resource use and protection, there are some. But in my view, a lot of them aren't clear enough in terms of how far they go in terms of protecting the environment. So they're a bit weak.
How well does law deal with some of these special topic areas? I say biodiversity.
Yes.
Hugely complex science.
Yes.
How does law cope with that?
Well, the recent work that I've been doing suggests that we're not dealing with it very well in a range of areas. I've come to the conclusion that we have problems with the level of standard we apply in terms of protecting the environment. We have real problems with being consistent across environments and across species. And we also have considerable difficulty in terms of implementing what we say we intend to do. So my view is that we don't deal with the issue of biodiversity very well at all. And I think, you know, I've written recently to suggest that just as we know that our landscapes are fragmented, so too is our law. So we have a double up of problems. We have fragmentation of law and legal institutions as they apply to biodiversity, as well as fragmentation of the land and the areas which the fauna inhabits in particular. And this is problematic when you have mobile fauna moving across a landscape, because you have a fragmented legal landscape and a fragmented actual landscape.
Sticking with biodiversity as an example,
yes.
You could change it to something harder if you like.
No.
Climate change.
No.
Are those things legally defined?
In
law?
Biodiversity legally defined?
Mm.
Yes. Basically, in terms of simply the variety of species and organisms. So biodiversity is very, very broad. At law, we manage biodiversity in a range of different ways. And so we have the Wildlife Protection Act, which will give absolute protection to certain species. And then we'll have the Resource Management Act that will protect insignificant habitats of indigenous fauna. So aspects of biodiversity will be protected in different ways by different pieces of legislation. Some of it will be area-based, some of it will be species-based, some of it will be driven at a particular problem, for instance, like water quality or air quality. It's vast, and to my mind, currently not quite adequate.
So if you were to pick on a more ecological science term, niche, succession, any of those sorts of things, are they separately defined in law, or does the law rely on the science?
Law will commonly, in those situations, rely on a scientific definition, but there is great difficulty with topics such as resilience, because resilience is a word that, you know, has a very clear scientific definition, but it has been transposed into social, cultural areas as well, and the word becomes used in different ways. So that's an example of where I'm not quite sure the meaning has caught up in all areas. Same with things like ecological integrity or what integrity means. There are different definitions, and that does create some difficulties in terms of what it is. The law's role is, when the law is aiming to protect something, that it will usually create a definition. But it's in the absence of that definition that we have a great deal of problem, like, for instance, with sustainable management. We've recently had the Supreme Court come out in the King Salmon case to discuss how Section 5 of the RMA, for instance, should be applied when dealing with a plan change in the Marlborough Sounds. And so the courts will need to come out and clarify these things when the legislation doesn't do that, because it wants to be open and broad, if that makes sense.
You talked briefly there about various acts, one of them the Wildlife Protection
The Wildlife, Wildlife Act. Protection.
So it protects certain species? Is it?
Well, actually, in New Zealand there is a basic presumption that all wildlife is absolutely protected unless that protection is removed through being listed in one of the schedules. One of the schedules immediately removes protection for most introduced species, but the standard is intended to be that New Zealand wildlife is absolutely protected. But my research shows that that's a standard that's diluted in a range of ways, in a range of significant ways, because if it was true, we wouldn't have the problem that we do of having some of the highest rates of threatened species in the world, while using the example of birds and freshwater fish.
Does it protect them in terms of direct physical harm?
Yes.
Does it also protect them in terms of systemic degradation of habitats?
That's a very, very good question. That hits the nail on the head. There is absolute protection in many instances from, take, for like hunting and killing directly, but not in every instance. Like, there's exceptions for the fisheries industry and things like that. Perhaps if we use the example of the black petrel, which is a bird I've studied, that bird is one of the most, or the most, heavily impacted by fisheries bycatch. But it is a threatened species, but there are exceptions for the fisheries industry in terms of bycatch. And so the premise of absolute protection is diluted in the way that the law is constructed and applied. So that's one example in terms
Can you use the Fisheries Act, sorry, not the Fisheries Act, can you use the Wildlife Protection Act to say this habitat must be protected?
Well, that's the next. So we have protection from take, direct take, and that has those exceptions. But then there's a very muddy area related to incidental take, perhaps when habitat is modified or destroyed. And my investigation has told me that what the greatest problem we have is we have a very poor intersection between the Resource Management Act, when people are out there using, perhaps a digger to create access tracks or wetland drainage or whatever. There's a poor intersection there between the controls that need to happen in terms of that work and the Wildlife Act protection, or the premise of absolute protection. We need to resolve that intersection better in terms of how we protect those species that will be subject to that form of loss. Now, the law suggests that they should be protected from that, but the implementation of that law is not good in New Zealand.
Can you give international listeners, or maybe even New Zealand listeners, the very quick version of the Resource Management Act?
Oh, yes, I suppose I can, if I have to. All 400 or whatever sections of it. It's the principal act intended in New Zealand to manage the use, protection and development of natural and physical resources and governed by the purpose of sustainable management. So what it does is it sets up a framework in relation to all the resources, which underneath it sets up a whole lot of plans and policies which will regulate the types of permits that you need to obtain if you wish to use or develop with resources, and the types of conditions that might be applied to that use. So,
when it was created, it was heralded as first in the world stuff.
Yes, it was.
Was it?
Yes, it was. It was. It was groundbreaking in a lot of ways. It was exciting, particularly because it followed a philosophy of integration. And prior to that, a lot of our law was in pieces, and it came into being along with the understanding about the interconnection of our resources, and that you can't deal with these things in isolation. And so the law was designed to reflect the interconnection of nature and resources, and dealing with all aspects at once, rolled up together, so that we can consider those flow-on effects and capture them all. Now, this is clever. This is a good thing to do. It was also governed by the purpose of sustainable management, which introduced the idea of environmental limits. Again, very progressive and good. My understanding, there's a great deal of criticism of the Act now, and there's attempts to weaken it. I find that, frankly, hard to understand from my perspective why you would ever need to weaken the environmental protection provided by the RMA, because in my view, fundamentally, it's insufficient. And so I cannot follow the argument that suggests that the RMA, in terms of the purpose and protection of purpose and principles of the Act, should in any way be lessened, because, you know, most resource consents, only 5% are notified. Below 1% are declined. And so when you look at the figures of how many resource consents are granted and how little public participation there is in terms of their grant, it's like, well, what are you complaining about? And instead, what we are seeing is intensifying and increasing loss of biodiversity and increasing numbers of threatened species and an increasingly degraded environment. So I think there are still quite a lot of things we could do quite usefully with the RMA, but my view is that it should be strengthened.
So what would you do to strengthen it?
Well, to begin with, I think the way that we approach avoidance of effects is not very brave. And I think for a lot of irreversible harm, significant harm, to particularly to threatened species, we should be being much more robust in terms of the way we define our policy and in terms of the way we enable human development patterns. This is not saying that we should stop it in any way. This is just arguing that we need to better enable coexistence in a range of ways by better providing for habitat within urban areas, better leaving undisturbed areas, that is preservation, of the very few areas that are left now, and better working of corridors and avoiding habitat destruction in the rural areas. So really bringing much better opportunities for coexistence right across the landscape and conservation across the landscape.
You talked before about corridors and landscape and scale. Does environmental law manage well those truly spatial functions?
In my view, no, not particularly well, for several reasons. That the silos that are created by the law are a problem to begin with. The fragmentation created by property ownership, the difficulties of ownership of species and responsibilities for species, all of those things cause to dissect the landscape and dissect our protection. And so, no, in my view, no, we don't.
On a global scale, we have whales moving around the world.
Yes.
Living in 4 or 5 different places.
Mm.
Seems to me we've got no chance of. We don't have structures for considering who owns those whales, or if in fact anybody can own those whales and who's responsible for them.
Yeah.
Maybe we do at an international level, but do we do the same thing locally?
We have real problems, I think, in New Zealand when it comes to it. The first thing is that wildlife is the property of the Crown. And I would suggest right from the outset that the Crown is seriously struggling to manage its property. It's clearly said that it doesn't have the resources to manage it on public land, but to intensify that problem. The position is that, you know, a lot of the threatened species now are found on private land, and even though the Crown owns that wildlife on private land, they won't. I mean, it's, if they're not managing it on public land, how is that going to happen on private land? So immediately we have a problem in terms of where our threatened species are located. Now, there are good examples. For instance, the kokako, a bird seriously trashed by the depredation to the environment in the past 100 years. And I mean, we've lost the South Island kokako, we have the North Island, but now confined largely to the public estate, confined largely to protective reserves. It's not a very mobile bird, so it's kind of a poor flyer and it just hops around. But it's actually, for a bird that has been seriously threatened, it's actually moving upwards now in terms of its conservation status, because it is largely set within a protective reserve. So it, you know, provided the pest control continues in those areas, that bird will continue to exist within those very limited confines. It's not a great outcome, but it tells us something interesting, because what it tells me is that mobility, which in the past was a survival strategy, has become a liability in the Anthropocene. What I mean by that is that the kokako is doing okay because it can't move outside, or often won't, outside of the bounds of a protective reserve. Now, a New Zealand dotterel or a black petrel, Tycho the black petrel, is in a completely different position because they are much more widely distributed over areas that cannot be protected. And so we have those immediate problems with coexistence in the wider landscape, and it's our ability to manage those conflicts that I think are causing us a serious headache right now.
It's harder for communities to feel an ownership of something that's only there for the bit of the year, for starters.
Oh, yes. I think, though, the community of Aotea, Great Barrier Island, and the Hauraki Gulf are very close to Tycho the black petrel, which its only breeding area is on two islands in the Hauraki Gulf shore. It flies off to the California Current or wherever it goes to migrate, but it does come back. It comes back, and I think that the bird is very much a symbol of that community. But the dotterel, they're there all year round. Perhaps the godwit does migrate, but the communities in New Zealand still feel a very close affinity with these species, and I think have real concern about their ability to persist as well.
To what extent does the law explicitly recognise movement in landscapes? And I'm thinking that in rivers it seems to be sorted. It seems that downstream in a river is ticked off. We've got that sorted. But I'm thinking about other things that it's either less diffuse or that the movement is less obvious. It seems to harder.
Yeah, I think that's right. We have a real problem in New Zealand because a lot of our conservation protection is place-based. And so depending on, like, if you're in the public reserve, You should get more royal treatment than if you're out in the general environment, particularly in working lands. This says if you are a bird. And that is the problem, because a lot of birds will move in between these environments. And because the protection that applies to these areas is different, the birds are immediately exposed to greater problems in different areas, or, shall we say, greater levels of protection than in one area than another. For instance, there's greater protection in the coastal area. So a dotterel on the coast of the Coromandel will receive greater protection than when it flies inland, say 30 kilometres, which it may do. But those environments will be treated differently. And again, there will be better protection within the public estate often than there is on private land as well. But the birds will inhabit both.
I was speaking to Bruce Clarkson.
Yes.
Who was talking about urban ecology and restoration of indigenous systems.
Yes.
And beginning to treat whole cities as urban, also as in the same way that we used to treat offshore islands.
Yes.
That there is value in the urban areas, a lot of it being that there isn't any grazing.
Yes.
And that the predators are being controlled for other reasons.
Yes.
So if we start to consider the whole city as a, in the same way we might consider the natural system of a national park.
Yes.
What would we have to do to first recognise, but secondly protect and organise that?
I'll go back a little bit. The work done by Prof Clarkson is exciting, and I find it's one of those real indicators of our ability to develop coexistence and actually give us some hope in these areas. And what I can say first is in relation to the Waikato, just my own simple story was that when I moved here in, say, the early 90s, I moved onto a farm, and it was on the edge of Cambridge, and the landscape was completely devoid of any indigenous birds. Magpies, all the species that inhabited it were simply, you know, what I would call as a colonised landscape, all the introduced birds. Then the HALO project started off with protecting Maunga Tautere, the Ecological Island Reserve, Maunga Kaua, HALO project in Hamilton, and a whole lot of predator work done in those areas, and probably Prof Clarkson has talked to you about that. It took 12 years before I saw the first tui on the farm. Planted a massive amount of native tree species to try and bring the birds in. It still took 12 years. But by the time I left the farm in about 2011, I drove past a tree with 12 tui in it. So the change in the ecology was really significant as a result of the work done to try and bring back the bird life through the protection of these particular areas that were demonstrated as being useful. So the first thing I can say is it's actually fundamentally changed our life. Out there, there's a tree that had nothing when I first came to teach at the university. Now, sometimes there are 20 tui in it. And it's, you know, it really is a remarkable change. They tell me they have heard the first bellbird back in Hamilton. And so these changes can be made, and they really should be part of our urban fabric. And our failure to achieve that is, I think, you know, woeful. But in New Zealand, our greatest problem is eradicating pests. But we can do this. We can do this. We have the ability to trap. We've got a problem with cats because of the other social aspects, but it can be done. It's just needing to plan for the landscape and for the species that inhabit it. And I think we should be doing it. I don't think urban areas should be left behind. In fact, perhaps they could lead.
Do ecosystems, in particular the distributed ecosystems, rather than the things that have got a fence around them and called a reserve, do they have protection?
You mean legal protection?
Yeah.
No, lots of the scrubby little patches wouldn't know. Some of them will, but actually my experience is, and I live on a gully now in the side of Cambridge, is that the gully, there's certainly no legal protection of this gully in terms of its vegetation. The vegetation is wild, rambly, weedy, nothingness in terms of special trees, but it has become a sink for biodiversity. It's one of the last remaining sinks, probably because it's so awful that no one ever could, you know, get to controlling it or cutting down or particularly not making it pristine. And I know that Prof Clarkson's view is that we need to replant with the native species to return them, but right now anything that we've got, I think, is a benefit, and it is these wild, untouched and forgotten areas in our urban landscape that I think are actually something we need to focus on as well. And removing predators from those areas would be another boost.
But while we're seeing the value of those in terms of the ecological hotspots, they're also extremely vulnerable.
Oh,
someone could come and decide to develop it.
Yeah.
And have no standing whatsoever.
That's right. They do need protection in that way. Currently, I don't think many of them would be attractive, except we have had a big expressway go right through where, you know, close to where I live. But, you know, they would be undevelopable because of the slope. And I know that even the properties that are above the slope have to be well set back. And so they are a wasteland. They could possibly be used for some recreational purpose, but they couldn't be developed, or it would... It's unlikely that they would be, because they're not not geologically very safe. But yes, I think that any area that has threatened species inhabiting it would deserve protection of some kind.
What do we do about the hard ones that we don't seem to be able to solve? The dolphin that everybody seems to be wringing their hands over while it's going extinct.
Well, the Maui dolphin, it seems that we just haven't acted quickly enough. I know that there's a lot of interests involved that don't want to have the interest curtailed in terms of, you know, the patterns of use of resources that they want to sustain. But I just think when you're down to however many species, what are we down to with the Maui? It's very low now, maybe 50. Yeah, and I think we need to keep trying no matter what. I don't think we should ever give up. I just don't believe in ever giving up. And, you know, people may say, well, that's irresponsible, but I think it's worth a try, always.
We interviewed someone whose name completely escapes me, and that's embarrassing, but somebody from the World Whale Dolphin Conservation, he talked about the dolphins in the Mekong River,
yes,
which everybody stood around and said this is terrible, but it's a wicked problem and it's hard and we're trying to figure it out, and meanwhile they went extinct. Mm. So his line, Andy Reid, thank you, his line was that being wicked is not an excuse for not doing anything.
Well, I feel like that about everything. I think that we you know, things are hard, life can be hard. I mean, yeah, I just think that we should always try.
Does planning, does environmental law promote doing stuff?
Positive action. Yes.
I mean, we talk about the precautionary principle.
Yes.
But it seems to be an excuse of not doing anything.
Well, I think it's because we are not really applying the precautionary principles with sufficient active intent. If we strengthened up our resolve and were a bit tougher on what we believe in and what we want to believe in and where we want to go, I'm sure we could make the precautionary principle incredibly effective. It really is dependent upon our will, and it depends on how hard a line we want to draw in terms of limiting or constraining people's rights to use and development resources. And my view is that we could do that a little bit more firmly.
Around the legal table, so to speak, we've talked about how species don't have an explicit representation.
Mm-hmm.
But neither do people, and I'm talking about future people. And if one of our principles is intergenerational integrity, equity.
Yeah. You're saying, do we, you know, should people come at the top of the tree, and should we put their needs before other species?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's an argument that's made enough, but currently I think there is enough to go around. Yes, we have a population explosion problem, but I believe if we plan and conserve the environment and the landscape, we will have a better chance than we do currently. I think it's the belief that we can have access to everything that is driving the problem. I think we need to be able to look at our patterns of consumption and the way we use resources and really reflect on that very closely to consider what it is that we wish to leave for our future generations. I'm sure we will be viewed as a very profligate generation. I'm sure that people will look back and heap shame upon us for our inability to control our consumptive choices. And we're all responsible for that. My own view is that we shouldn't, again, say it's a wicked problem, it's nothing we can do about it. I think we actually need to effect change sooner and be more thoughtful about the choices that we do leave our children and our grandchildren.
It's interesting the we that you're describing there, because I think in environmental movements, environmental law, it's developers versus the rest of us, but those developers are doing it on our behalf.
That's right, and we use all of those resources. We are driving that production because we're buying it, or however we're acting. And I think we need to reflect simply on the extent of resources that we are consuming, particularly those non-renewable resources. And I don't personally believe that technology will in the future provide for everything. I'm talking to my first year students just last week about, well, what do you want to see left for your children? You know, do you think they should be entitled to see a pristine beach, for example? Because, I mean, in the Waikato, we have an example in the Coromandel at the moment of New Chums Beach being developed. And we had a debate about whether or not, people were entitled to... in future generations to have access or experience to pristine resources. And then we also get involved in a whole lot of property rights debates as well. So, they're difficult questions, but my own view is that we could do better.
Would you describe the environmental planners that you produce as being sustainable?
That's an interesting question. And so really I guess that is are they leaving here with a sustainable ethic? Would they be sustainable? Would they have a sustainable philosophy, a philosophy based on sustainability? It's a difficult question because you can't actually test them all in that. But the interesting thing is that I think a lot of people who come into this profession in the first place are interested or genuinely wish to be engaged in how you plan forward for the world. So a lot of the young people that I see, they're bright, energetic, vibrant people looking out towards what they can do with their lives, and I think they do see environmental planning as somewhere that they can actually make a difference. And so I think there would be a strong slice of our cohort of students who definitely are that way inclined. They're often, sports people, they're often involved in the outdoors a lot, or they're very thoughtful as well. And so, I think there would be some. But of course, we also have plenty of children of farmers. We have very, very varied collection of students at the university, and we have a wide range of perspectives that we welcome and engage with. And this is about understanding where we should be going forward with environmental policy. Yes, I have a leaning towards the green, and probably that is influential to a degree, but not entirely, because, there is room in this world for a range of perspectives.
Could you successfully graduate your degree holding firm a belief that growth is wonderful and that this notion of finite resources is fairy tale?
No. I don't think so. I think it would be seen that we were the ones living a fairy tale. I don't think that is possible. I don't think when you get out there and you look at the reality of the environment in terms of the finite amount of elite soils, protecting soils, protecting water quality, protecting air quality, I don't think that we could go and do that. No. I don't think it's possible.
Could somebody graduate
with that idea intact?
Yeah.
No. No, they might still hold very strongly. But I remember I had a student who first came in to me and he announced in a class quite early on, there is no such thing as global warming. I know. His position had changed by the time he got to fourth year. That wasn't because we particularly tried to. It was simply because he was exposed to a great deal more evidence and information and knowledge about the world and about the condition of the world and, in terms of just research. But it would be possible to hold dearly to anything, I believe, if you really chose to and come out blinkered. It's possible.
It might be difficult to tell, given that you've started a new degree, but do you think the schools are doing a better job?
The schools are are the schools doing a better job in terms of sustainability? Well, I think we've had some great initiatives here. I've got four kids and they've gone to the local schools, and the regional council has had some great programs involved with environmental education. And so at school, the primary school my children went to was was bilingual. And it was backed up by the regional council in terms of the environmental education. So they ran worm farms and grew a lot of trees and actively involved in anti-litter and pollution. And then they moved through to high school. Seems to me if they studied geography and a bit of science and ecology, they're reasonably well-versed. But at the same time, they're constantly exposed to a great big torrent of information about consumption. And they are. There's been an immense change just even in the last 10 years in terms of the type of technology and gadgets and items that are available to that younger generation. So I think it's swings and roundabouts, really.
And the torrent of information about consumption is, yay, let's have a party. And the alternative story is a bit more dour than that.
More boring, probably. For them, it's not quite as shiny, no. But I actually think most of the young people, one thing I noticed, they don't come to university with a strong understanding of government and systems. They're very weak there. But they do have an idea. The students that we see are very interested often in terms of the way that resources are used in the world. We run a Facebook page, and it's a very popular Facebook page through the program, and the students can post to it themselves and contribute and share items throughout the world, and yeah, they're active in terms of those aspects.
Given that not everybody can possibly be an environmental planner,
yes,
are there some messages that environmental planning can give to everybody else in that work that they're doing or the lives that they're doing? Not necessarily about environmental planning, but are there some principles that could be used?
Well, a lot of the principles would be related to things like the engagement of people in decision making. So the role of public participation, the role of communities, the role of people, and how fitting policies and rules to people is often improved by engagement. So that's probably a fundamental idea that, you know, feeds out into other areas as well. The idea of environmental limits is also very important. And the idea of strategizing, policy making and planning forward, looking forward, and planning with uncertainty is also something that you can apply across a range of disciplines. So there are methods that planning brings that can be used more widely across other disciplines.
What's the premise behind public participation is good?
Oh, you want me to start teaching planning theory? That is not my role. The premise is basically, in resource management terms, that often the people who are engaged with using the resources know them best and will be best suited to contribute to the decision-making. You know, the opposite side of it is the experts know best, they know better than the community, and they should make the rules. But my experience is, you know, working in legal practice, doing submissions on behalf of the local federated farmers group on district plans and things like that, you know, that is the truth. They know the resources. I mean, I remember working with a group of them about bush protection. And they were sensible. They would say things like, well, hang on, these bush protection rules are fine and we're really happy to support them. However, we want to be able to keep our pastures clear. Or we need to have an airstrip in this area, or gravity feed tanks need to go in this position. So understanding the realities of the environment when you create protection is very important. And so public participation in that is really helpful because you understand the challenges. And it also therefore means that when rules are made, they are more palatable because they will work better for the people who have to interface with them.
And this planning with uncertainty is always a challenge. I think uncertainty is one of the big challenges that the public doesn't get. Uncertainty in terms of science terms, but also in terms of you're dealing with this mushy thing and you're trying to do this thing, but you build this reserve and the birds might choose not to live here and you don't know why.
That's right. Oh, look, planning and uncertainty and scientific uncertainty is one of the greatest challenges of making of any form of plan or policy for the future. I went to an interesting talk last night by an international professor, Graham Horton, a geographer from Manchester who's here as a visiting fellow for a short period of time, and he was talking about the way that lines on maps are made and that the models behind those maps may be very uncertain, but we accept them for the moment, and those lines on map can create liabilities. And the difficulty of uncertainty in mapping, perhaps, you know, he was using the example of floodline mapping. So it is a real problem in terms of planning and outcomes, and also how the community relate to those aspects as well.
Okay, some questions to finish with. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No.
What motivates you?
I think probably my deep love for this country. And it's just very simple. Grew up here, love it. Don't think there's anywhere better in the world to live. Love our sea, love our mountains, love it all, and also my kids.
What challenges do you face in the next couple of years?
Getting all my marking done. What challenges in the next couple of years? Oh, they're just ongoing, really, the same issues. Just trying to persevere with improving our systems so that they work better to do what they're intended to do. And there's lots of examples of that, and I will just keep on going with those.
What's going to happen with the Resource Management Act?
Well, the government currently has a majority. It's indicated its intention to change the principles of the Resource Management Act. Therefore, it is likely to.
If you could have a miracle occur by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, what would it be?
Oh, a miracle occur. I think probably the miracle I would want is that there is enough food and clean water for every creature in this world, humans and animals alike.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
I'm not really in the habit of giving advice, but I think the most important thing, it is incumbent upon us to be positive about our world.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's Sustainable Lens was that of Dr. Pip Wallace, the convener of environmental planning at the University of Waikato. We recorded this conversation in April before the Northland by-election and the effect that election had on the government's ability to force through substantive changes to the Resource Management Act. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.